Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. So you know that time the phone rings, you know who it is, and you just can't bear to pick it up. It isn't your mother-in-law. It's worse. It's the debt collector. But maybe ignoring that call countless times isn't the best thing to do. Doug Hoyes of Hoyes, Michaelos & Associates is here to talk about how to handle those calls and to debunk some myths about the debt collection agencies. Then, as retirement savings is retirement savings, the last thing on your mind, can't be absolutely the last thing because you're listening to a money show. But if it's close to the last thing, you may be in trouble when it comes to retirement decades down the road. We're going to talk to Randy Cast from Nest Wealth about his holy trinity of retirement savings. And advice for the living. What happens on your taxes when you die? Now, that's a cheery thought, isn't it? Manulife's John Natale is here to talk about death and taxes. And finding your right financial advisor is a lot harder than a lot of tasks out there. Some people would argue it's harder than online dating. You can't just upload a cute but dated photo and swipe left. There is a new online site that might help. It's called Matchworth. Co-founder Robert Irwin will be here. Plus Mike Foy from J.D. Power on this year's Full Service Investor Survey. We are not happy, people. We're not happy. All that is ahead. Let's get started. If you're lucky, you have never received a call from a collection agency. But millions of people have. Probably many, many calls if they get on that list. So what should you do when the phone rings? Answer, send it to voicemail. And what are your rights? Just how mean are they allowed to be? Doug Hoyes from Hoyes, Michaelos & Associates joins us now to talk about how to deal with debt collection agencies and to debunk some of the most common myths. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
How does someone get on the radar of a collection agency in the first place?
You owe money. That would be the most common
answer. But for how long do you need to not have paid to pass the bill off to collections?
So there's internal and external. So you're a month behind on your credit card, then the internal collector at the bank's going to be calling you. It's usually about 2, 3, 4, 5 months when the original creditor says, you know what, we don't want to be having our own internal people bugging our customers. We're going to send you to a third-party collection agency. Let them bug you. So in most cases, you're at least 3 months behind, and it could be 6 months or more.
Is that first call a nicer call if it comes from the institution?
Yes. Because the institution still wants to save you. So there's still some hope here.
Do they sort of assume, like, I'm sure your check got lost in the mail. How can I help?
That's exactly how the sequence starts. So you miss a payment. Your credit card statement says, oh, you probably just forgot to send it. If you did, disregard this message. The second month, it's a little more snarkily worded. And that's probably when you're getting a phone call from the internal person. By the third month, it's, well, we've closed down your account. You can't use it anymore. And then it's month 4 or 5 where they've now sent it off to a third-party collection agency. And that's where the real fun begins.
And these are Canadian companies, these collection agencies?
Yep.
How do they make their money?
In most cases, it's a straight commission deal. So the first handoff, so the original creditor is sending it to collection agency ABC, and they say to him, look, this guy's fresh meat. He's only, you know, been behind for 3 or 4 months. He was a great customer for a long time. So here's the deal. Whatever you collect, you can keep 10%, send us the rest. And I just made that up. I don't know what their own internal deals is. But the first handoff, they're making, you know, less of a commission. If they don't collect anything after 3 or 4 months, they send it back to the bank and say, here you go. We couldn't do anything with it. So then the second handoff is to a collection agency that perhaps specializes in people who are now a year behind. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe the commissions are a little bit higher. The deal's a little bit better for them at that point.
If we think about getting anyone to do something we want them to do, there are two approaches. There is kind and there is ferocious. The stereotype is that the collection agencies go the ferocious path. Why is that? Is it that much more effective?
Well, I think the stereotype is wrong because I know lots of collection agents who do the first one. That's, hey, look, let me be your friend here. You're on my list. If you can just shoot me.
How can I help?
Yeah, if you shoot me $10, I can at least get you off the list of having not paid you. Those are the ones you really got to worry about. The ones who are yelling and screaming, well, yeah, I'm probably just going to hang up the phone. But the ones who say, why don't you just send me $10, they realize that in Ontario, and the laws are different in different provinces, but similar, that in Ontario, they've got to sue you within 2 years of when you stop making a payment. Well, if you haven't made a payment for 2 years, but you send them $10, guess what? You've restarted the clock, bing, bang, boom. So the friendly guy might be the guy you got to worry about more.
tell us about your rights. So we'll use Ontario, given that that's where we're recording this interview. We can use that even if things are different federally. What are some things that consumers should keep in mind that they can trust, that the law supports?
Well, there's the forest and there's the trees. So if you want to get down and dirty, they can only call you at certain times of the day. I mean, in Ontario, it's pretty much all the time, 7 in the morning till 9 at night, Monday to Saturday, you know, 1 to 5 p.m. on a Sunday. They're not allowed to be abusive. They can't swear, you know, all that sort of thing. They're not allowed to be just calling randomly every neighbor and friend you've got, but they are allowed to call your neighbors, your family, your employer to confirm your contact information. So they do have a fair amount of leeway. I think the bigger picture, though, is, okay, why are they calling you? Well, if it's because they've got the wrong guy, then tell them they got the wrong guy. Prove that you've already paid the debt and put it, be done with it. Probably the reason they're calling you is you owe the money. So maybe what you need to be doing then is dealing with the underlying issue, which is, okay, I owe the money. Yeah. So can I make a deal with them? Can I work something out? Can I do something? And that's what stops the calls ultimately.
So you pick up the phone. They say you owe us money. Where do things go from there if you are an engaged consumer really looking for a solution?
Well, so the first thing I guess I would say to them is, can you send me a letter? Because the law says you have to notify me in writing that you are now the collector for this account if it's a third-party agency. So they have to put it in writing who they're collecting for, how much you owe, what the whole deal is. So if it is a case of mistaken identity, if it's a case of you already paid it, then that perhaps brings it to an end right there. And if it's somebody who's collecting some account from 5 years ago, and you know that the law in Ontario, and it's very similar in other provinces, is that the limitations period is around 2 years for most debts, then they're probably not going to be able to take you to court. That may then show them that you're an informed consumer and may stop the calls right there. But if it's a case of, yeah, you know what, I do owe this money, if you're getting a call from one collection agent, there's probably three others who are lined up to call you too. So maybe it's time then to look at a bigger picture situation. So what can I do to deal with all this debt? Because the last thing you want to do is resurface after being underground for a while. Maybe you've just started a new job and you've flashed on their radar again. So fine, this guy's calling me. I'm going to send him $50 to get him off my back. Well, guess what? He now reports to the credit bureau that you've started making payments. So all those other guys who haven't gotten payments from you for a while,
smell blood.
Oh, they smell blood, and now boom, you've made the phone ring even more.
You are a licensed insolvency trustee,
yes.
Correct? When should people be talking to a nonprofit credit counselor, and when should they be talking to you?
Well, my answer is call me, because I'm the one licensed by the federal government to deal with all these things. A not-for-profit credit counselor is good for helping you with things like budgeting, getting back on track. If you've got a relatively small amount of debts, you know, I owe an old phone bill and I'm not really sure how much I can send them every month, a not-for-profit credit counselor is fine for helping you work that out. But if there is any threat of a wage garnishment, court action, anything like that, that's a legal process. You're going to need a legal solution to deal with that. And so in Canada, the two legal solutions are a consumer proposal or a personal bankruptcy, which stop garnishments. Mm. That's what stops them in their tracks.
And you probably get a lot of referrals from nonprofit credit counselors.
Yeah, we get referrals from all over. I mean, people we've dealt with in the past is a huge source of referrals too for us.
Take us through the essence of the repayment steps. So how does this work if you do have the funds that you can at least, you know, scratch your way towards making some payments and you're really trying to avoid the bankruptcy filing or consumer protection? What does that part look like?
Well, the collection agent would much rather get a lump sum from you. So if it's an old phone bill that's now $1,000, if you say to them, look, I can come up with $400 tomorrow, next week, they're probably likely to take that right off the rest. Because again, they're getting a commission on whatever they collect. A commission on $400 today is way better than a commission on $50 over the next 2 years. So if you can come up with a lump sum, the starting point is, here's my lowball offer and start with
and
that.
And would it be, so that one in that case was a 40% lowball offer. Is that where you would start?
It's time sensitive. So if this debt is more than 2 years old, I'd be starting at 10 cents because there's really not a whole lot they can do to me. If it was something from a couple of months ago, well, you're probably going to have to pay pretty much the whole thing. So the older it is, the lower I would start and throw it out there, see what they say.
What other myths on the debt collection process are out there? Any other thing, any preconceptions that we should correct?
Well, I think the two big ones would be, well, they're going to put me in jail or they're going to start garnishing my wages or something like that. And they always threaten that or hint that they're threatening that. But in order to garnish someone's wages, you got to get a court order. You got to go to court. You got to sue the person. That takes time. That takes money. So the chances of a collection agency actually taking you to court are probably about 1 in 10,000. It's just, it's not something they do. They're earning a 10% commission. They're going to spend all this money on lawyers to sue you. The original creditor, the bank, sure, they're take people to court all the time, but a collection agency, no. And I think the other myth would be that you have to pay them. Well, no, you don't. There are all these other options we've just talked about. And again, paying one of them and leaving three others to smell the blood in the water is just going to make things worse.
If the call has already gone out to the collection agencies, does that mean the damage is already done to your credit score?
There is already a note on your credit report that you're behind. Yes.
Right.
So that's why I say, okay, people come, and I've had a few conversations already with people today before we recorded this interview. And I say to all of them, look, your credit's already impaired.
Right.
You're already months and months behind. So would it not be better to, instead of worrying about your credit report, which is already damaged, deal with the problem and be done with it?
I asked how the collection agencies are paid. How are you paid?
In a consumer proposal, our fees are set by the government, same in a bankruptcy. So it's a tariff set by the government. Every licensed insolvency trustee gets the same percentage of the money that's distributed to the creditors.
So from a purely business standpoint, your clients that have a lot of money outstanding, that they are doing a large consumer proposal or a large bankruptcy filing, is better for your bottom line.
The clients who have a lot of assets or would have income in a bankruptcy end up paying more in a proposal. So it's more related to their assets and income than it is to the debt that we're settling.
Interesting. Well, thank you for your context. And boy, am I relieved I haven't had this personal experience in this area.
Thanks, Bruce.
Doug Hoyes, Hoyes, Michaelos & Associates. He's a licensed insolvency trustee.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
The question I get asked more than almost any other is, can you recommend a great financial advisor for me? And I totally wish I could help, but there are so many variables that go into finding the right fit. So far, there isn't a TripAdvisor or a Yelp, kind of the equivalent of those things in the land of financial advisors. But there have been a number of services that have tried. And we're going to take a look at another one that is just getting started. It is called Matchworth. Robert Irwin is co-founder. He joins us now. Hello there.
Hello.
So many recommendations out there in so many other categories. I mentioned TripAdvisor. There's Rank My Professor. There's Angie's List for contractors. What makes the financial advice space so much more difficult?
It's a great question. There are so many different variables to take into account, and every individual person has specifics that they want to see in an advisor. And it's really hard to standardize that across the board. We're making good inroads into solving that problem for sure, but it's custom. Everyone's personal.
So tell us about your model. How's it work? How's Matchworth work?
Essentially, Matchworth is the first unaffiliated online platform in Canada for regular Canadians to find, evaluate, and choose a financial advisor who suits their needs, not the bank's.
Now, I don't know if I'd say first, because I worked on Money Sense Approved,
and while that isn't
still in market, that was what we were trying to do with there. How do the steps work here?
Well, the steps work. The individual can come into land on the site, create an investor profile, which really is more about asking the investor what they're looking for in an advisor and less about themselves. And the algorithm that we have matches them to an advisor who's on that platform. And we give some recommendations. They're not hard recommendations. You can cycle through and change that filter to find what you're looking for. But the way it differs from anything that MoneySense would have had on that advisor list, it's essentially a static list, whereas this is an engagement platform. So we encourage the investor to ask questions that are meaningful to their personal financial situation. And advisors essentially compete for that business. The investor is anonymous the whole time.
You ask some qualitative questions. So you've asked the quantitative questions like assets under management and income and province and all that stuff. But some of the qualitative questions include, do you prefer your advisor to be traditional or creative?
Yeah.
I wasn't even sure what that meant.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, in their hobbies? Like, do we need a visual artist? What did you mean by that?
Well, traditional versus creative. I was an advisor for 15 years, and a lot of the colleagues that I had were great people, but we all treated our practices differently. And some of them were very traditional in the sense that they would go by the book and follow standard patterns, and some would be more creative in their approach to problem solving. And it's an individual, it's a very personal thing for the advisor as well as the investor.
How do you factor in the different ways in which advisors are compensated? So three methods, basically: commission-based, fee-based, and fee-only, which we talk a lot about on this program. Most Canadians don't even know that there is a fee-only option there. How do you navigate that? How do you make that a part of the evoked set of advisors you offer up, given that fee-based doesn't work for someone with assets under management of, you know, less than 250, maybe even less than 500?
Well, what we do is we make an attempt at essentially educating the investor. So once they're aware of it, it becomes, you know, now they start looking for it. We filter through that with the algorithm, so you get matched accordingly. And then most importantly, we encourage investors to start a conversation with the advisors to find the actual nuanced answer they're looking for and filter out the advisor that or find the advisor that matches with what they're looking for. Exactly.
This is free for the investor,
always,
correct? And so how much does an advisor pay to participate, to get themselves included in your algorithm?
All advisors are invited to our site. We're unaffiliated. We have all the basic data for all advisors in Canada on the site. And you can come claim that profile for free as an advisor, and you can get matched to an investor for free. The charge to the advisor is a flat rate monthly or annual. It's just over $1,000 annually. And it's not related to how many matches or connections they get. It's just a flat rate access to communicate to those investors.
How do you vet them? So you say everybody's able to be on your site. How do you vet them? Because some would have, you know, at its simplest, some would have complaints against them by regulatory bodies or other kinds of things. But then there's a lot of other nuances that would have you, if you were talking to your best friend and you had three advisors you could recommend to them, you might say, I'm not sure about that one. Don't do that one. So how do you vet them?
So we have everyone's invited. Again, being unaffiliated, we have to keep that door open. But we have a badge, a vetted badge. Or a verified badge, sorry.
That goes like the good housekeeping seal of approval.
Very similar, yeah. And we just go through, it's at the advisor's request to have themselves verified. If they send an inquiry in saying, hey, I'd love to get verified, they just send that to us and we go through our steps. And that's a manual process we go through.
And what are you verifying?
Well, we cross-reference the CSA data and the disciplinary action from their website. So we just manually look at that. We ask them a series of questions. We verify their approach to investment that is consistent with their licensing, meaning what they're offering, what they can provide advice on, what they can sell. And then we also even go into some of their clients and ask for discussions with them to verbally verify a lot of that.
How do you think about geography? Because I think most people would choose an advisor that they could go meet in person every once in a while, but we're in a world in which so many professional services are offered remotely. So if I say I'm from, you know, the city of Calgary, am I only going to get connected to people who are based in Calgary, or could the search be farther afield?
Well, right now, I mean, we're fairly new, so the data we have, we've had to sort of loosen the algorithm a little bit to allow that people do get matched. And as that those numbers increase, we'll tighten it up to be very specific. So for sure, some people want to be, they're indifferent as to where their advisor is using virtual tools. And that's one of the questions the advisor answers. They have a whole series of questions that they answer on the site to help differentiate their value, their offering as well. So it depends on, right now, yes, geography, it's based on what the investor is looking for.
You're talking about a match here, but not a marriage. So if we put it into an online dating world, you're kind of the Tinder or OkCupid or Plenty of Fish or whatever the sites are. I've been married for a very long time. I don't know the sites, but whatever those sites are.
So I'm told.
All those out there. What then should an investor be asking to see if this is the right fit? So you've done the algorithm, which means they're going on a first date for coffee, but how does the investor then determine if this is someone that they should go on a second date with or a third date?
So what we've done, and that's essentially the nucleus of the product we've created, is we want to create an environment where the engagement is real and the investor's anonymous. They can ask real questions, ideally tough questions, hold the advisor accountable to the things that matter most to that investor, and have these advisors compete for that business. And with those answers that the advisors clamor to answer, they love it. And the quality is fantastic. we feel the investor can find the nuances that differentiate the advisors amongst a large sea of homogeneity.
What questions should they ask in that first coffee meeting? So after they leave your platform, because they will then, you know, go and meet this person and maybe they'll meet three people from your platform. What is the number one thing that they should ask in real life? IRL. Look at me. Sounding like such a cool kid.
I would say, you know, really, it's very personal. It's mostly what we look at is the connection between the two people. Assuming they have their designations at that point, you've verified all these things, they're potentially a great advisor on paper. But what's going to last, what's going to be the variable that keeps these people together is their method of communication, how that works. Do they communicate as a top-down? Do they tell you how it works? So it's less about the questions and more about how they communicate. But if you were to ask a question directly, you know, I would ask them actually something peripheral to finance, something outside of finance. Ask them personal things about what is going on and how they've dealt with things in their life and some of the challenges. Because what happens is they're going to break down, they're going to jump out of that mold of the standard answer, and they're going to tell you more meaningfully from
their perspective. You don't mean literally break down, like break down into tears?
I hope not.
No.
I mean, that would be an extreme version, and that's going to tell you a lot of information about that advisor.
At least they can emote.
Yeah.
Well, best of luck with the launch. Rob, I appreciate you coming and talking to us about it.
Great.
Robert Irwin is co-founder of Matchworth. Coming up next on Moo La La, two truths and a lie. Manulife's John Natale is here to talk about death and taxes and fine bourbon, which is the lie, which it's a hint. Here's a hint. Manulife doesn't have a liquor license. And later, are you satisfied with your investment firm? A new study from J.D. Powers tells us that most likely you're not. Mike Foy will be here to tell us all about the findings there. If you do not want to ever miss an episode of Moo La La, you can subscribe to the show on any of the podcast platforms out there. Make sure that you subscribe, write a review, and go through the archives. Lots of great conversations from past episodes. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moo La La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Nothing is certain except death and taxes, said Benjamin Franklin. We thought it'd be smart to put two completely unappealing ideas into one interview. Death and taxes. But I promise this is going to be interesting and relevant stuff. John Natale is the head of tax, retirement, and estate planning services at Manulife. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
This is kind of killer cocktail party conversation here. Death and taxes. Does anyone invite you anywhere ever? Do you ever get invitations?
Not because of death and taxes.
Not because you just lie. Do you lie about what you do?
Absolutely.
Or you silently let them think you're part of the FBI Witness Protection Program, and then you're like super interesting. Yes,
I do lie about what I do sometimes.
Good
absolutely.
For you.
Yeah, for sure.
So best case, all the affairs are in order. The wills are in place. All that's in order. What are the tax implications when someone dies?
So that's a great question, Bruce. So when you pass away, any income you've earned up to that point in time is going to be reported on your final tax return, and that's called your terminal tax return. As well, when you die, you're deemed to have disposed of all of your assets. So, for example, any non-registered assets you have, mutual funds, stocks, segregated funds, they will be deemed to have been sold on the day you die, and you could trigger a capital gain or capital loss, depending on the market value relative to the adjusted cost base on that day.
What is different for the single person versus the married person?
That's a great question. So
all my questions are great. Every single one.
I'll stop saying that.
It's okay.
It's a given. So when you're married or you have a common law partner, at death, you can roll over your assets to them on a tax-deferred basis. So you avoid tax. And then when your spouse or common law partner receives those funds, when they eventually withdraw it, they'll pay tax. So you're deferring tax. You're not saving tax. What I tell people is a dollar of tax saved is great. A dollar of tax deferred is second best. And a dollar of tax evasion, you'll end up in jail.
Right. Okay, so that's the best case.
Yeah.
What's the worst case? You haven't done the appropriate planning. There's, you know, you're in the midst of a separation, but the divorce isn't final. I'm sure you see the most outrageous circumstances that no one could believe are true. What are some of the themes that link together the worst case scenarios?
Well, you know, the big theme is no planning, right? Mm. People haven't turned their mind to this at all. And in those situations, you see very unfortunate results. Because then what happens is, from a tax perspective, the government takes a much larger share than they really should have. There's less for your beneficiaries, the ones that you love. You've worked hard to accumulate all those assets for all of your life, and you want to pass those on to the people you care about. And now, one, the amount that's being given to them is going to be significantly reduced. The other one is not necessarily a tax issue, but as well just the amount of time to distribute your assets may take a lot longer. You may have to have your will probated. And when you submit your will for probate to the court, that takes time.
Just give us a sense. So if you've done everything right,
right,
how much time? If you've done very little right, how much time?
Well, a lot of nuances to that question. So if you've done everything right, you'll have a will and you'll have named beneficiaries where permissible. So, for example, on an RSP, a RIF, a TFSA, a non-registered psych fund. In those situations, when you name a beneficiary where you have the ability, that's fantastic because usually the death benefit will be paid to the beneficiary within a week or two of them receiving your document. So a huge advantage. And then with your will, if you have a properly drafted will, assuming that the probate process is smooth, usually 6 months to 9 months, everything can be paid out. If the will is poorly drafted, if the will is challenged.
If there is no will.
If there is no will, that's what we call you die intestate, then that process can take years.
So let's talk about the no will situation. Yeah. The stat that makes me insane is how few Canadians actually have a will, or even an up-to-date will would be one notch better. Yeah. What should they be aware in terms of the consequences that – their family members will suffer from them not having a will?
Well, so like I said, when you die without a will, you're deemed to have died intestate. So people think, you know, I die without a will, I don't have an estate plan. So what? That's actually not true. You do have an estate plan. It's the government's estate plan. So when you die without a will, each province has a piece of legislation that says who the assets go to. And they go by bloodline. So, for example, if you die without a will and you have a spouse or common law – actually, a spouse, but sometimes common law partners are excluded, actually. That's an important point as well. But if you have a spouse, everything goes to your spouse. And people say, well, that's fine.
My affairs are simple. Who cares?
But the problem is, what happens if you're separated? Mm-hmm. You don't have a formal divorce agreement. And let's say you hit your spouse's guts. That might be the last –
Never happens that
way. Never happens.
Never happens. Late.
That might be the last person you want your assets to go to. Secondly, so if you have a spouse, it goes to them. If you have children, then usually your assets are divided between your spouse and your kids. People again say, okay, that's no problem. That's most people, that's their plan, right? But what happens if you have minor kids? Well, if you have minor kids, they cannot inherit the assets. The money will usually be paid into court. So then you have to wait for them to turn 18, or someone has to make an application to court to get the money. And then the bad thing about that as well is once they turn age 18, they can demand all the funds. So there's a lot of consequences to dying without a will.
At what age or at what life circumstance should someone ensure that they draft a will to avoid some of the horrors that you talk about? I'm sure I was early. I drafted my first will at 18, but only because I was so mad at a friend, I wanted to write her out of my will. So I wrote the will to be like, I'll write you out of my will. So I'm sure you wouldn't advocate for that.
Right.
But for adults, at what age should they do it? A simple version.
Well, I think a lot earlier than most people think. I think as soon as you start to accumulate any assets, you know, you own a home, you have a family, you have kids, those kind of things. So I think for most people, you know, probably looking mid to late 20s, maybe early 30s, depending on your situation. But I think definitely by 30, but also depends a little bit on your family situation or your personal situation.
There are a lot of variables that go into estate planning, you know, how pensions work, kids, second marriages, all these kinds of things. What are some of the misconceptions that people have about that process and navigating the complexity of that process, especially later in life when, you know, you might not have had two marriages by the time you're 25, but by the time you're 75, you might have had multiple marriages, you might have stepkids, all those kinds of things.
Well, I think a couple things. One, you know, taxes for sure. A lot of people, even people I work with in the industry, you know, the tax world is a big world and they don't understand everything. So you need to make sure you speak to an expert. As a simple example, a lot of times people are surprised with pensions. When you have a defined benefit pension plan, the tax is actually to the recipient, not to the deceased, like it is with an RSP, just a simple example. The other thing that happens with estate planning and death is I think a lot of times people are too rigid. They try and plan things to the nth degree. And then what happens when life changes, when life throws them a curveball, they have to redraft their whole estate plan because there's no flexibility built into the estate plan.
What would be an example of that? Do you mean that you would have a framework for a percentage split of how your assets get divided by your kids instead of an absolute dollar value? Is that an example? Or what do you mean by rigid?
No, not exactly. What I mean by that is you set up, for example, a whole complicated network of trusts or sub-corporations like holdcos and things like that. And then, for example, like what happens, the government changes the rules on trusts or on taxation of investment income within a corporation and those kind of things. And now all of your planning is for naught. All the tax benefits or advantage that you thought you were going to be able to take advantage has been basically eliminated.
Isn't that view a little counterintuitive? Shouldn't you want people to make it as complicated as possible so people like you get the best fees?
Yes, they should. But I also do feel that we should be in the best interest of everybody. And the most important part, I think anybody in my position would say the same thing. The most important part is to look out for the benefit of our clients.
John, thank you for joining us today. I know it's a morbid topic. You deal with it all the time, but it is so, so important that we get people on side.
My pleasure.
John Natale, head of Tax, Retirement, and Estate Planning Services at Manulife. Stay with us. Coming up next, common collection agency myths. Doug Hoyes will be here. He's with Hoyes McLaughlin Associates. And Matchworth's Robert Irwin joins us for How I Do It. We'll ask him how he manages his money. Listening to Moolala on your commute to work is really easy. You just subscribe to our show and then it shows up on your device every single week. While you're at it, write us a review. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Saving for retirement may not be at the top of your priority list when you're younger. There's a mortgage, there's rep hockey, there's the vet bills. These are the things that grab your attention in the short term. But eventually, there will come a time when you begin to worry about your retirement and your savings and wish that it had been a little higher on your priority list all those years. Randy Cass is the founder of Nest Wealth, an automated investment platform. And he's here to talk about his holy trinity of retirement savings and why following those three things will make saving for retirement a lot less challenging. Hello there.
Hey, happy to be here.
Are you a religious man? Are you using this phrase Holy Trinity in a religious context?
Well, I'm Jewish, so if I'm using it in a religious context, it's probably the wrong context.
Right.
It grabs people's attention, and when you're talking about things that they might not always want to talk about, and that, let's face it, money, savings, wealth, it's something we like reading about, but it's kind of taboo to talk about it in polite company still. You need to grab them. And when you say it with the conviction of a term like the Holy Trinity, people listen up.
Group RSPs, personal savings, don't give away your growth in fees. I'm just revealing what the three things are, but I want to start off with group RSPs. This is something you believe in. Tell me why it's so important, and tell me why Canadians should care, given that not everybody has a group RSP, unfortunately.
Right. So a couple things to comment on and how you just introduced the segment at the top. I'm in my late 40s now. I had a
birthday.
You
look amazing.
Oh, thank you. So do you. Yeah, you look better. No, you look better. This is radio. We can say anything.
That's true.
That's a great head of hair you have. We were playing baseball recently, and when you get into your late 40s, you realize that the body doesn't quite move as much as it should have. But had I taken precautions in my 20s and 30s, I'd probably be dealing with a better raw material package than I am right now. Savings and money and wealth is the same sort of thing. And so when you start talking about where you end up, the earlier you have that conversation, the better off you're going to be and the easier you're going to find it to live the life you want to live in retirement. And in many cases, the very first time people have an occasion to decide if they're going to save and do things that seem to delay gratification is when they are working for someone that offers them a group savings plan, a group RSP, or we don't see them much anymore, but a defined benefit pension plan, or the middle ground is kind of a defined contribution plan. Don't worry about what the terms mean. The important thing to understand is your employer is offering you a really simple way to start saving for your future. In many cases, they'll actually not only give you a chance to take money before taxes come off and put them aside, but they'll also then give you free money in a matching type of arrangement to encourage you and make your money grow faster. And if you work at one of these places and they have a group RSP, and historically group RSPs really have been things of middle-sized companies, large-sized companies, but now with things like Nest Wealth at Work, group RSPs are available across the country for any company, even 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 employees. This is the way to start. This is the first pillar of that holy trinity. Given an opportunity to save, given an opportunity to take free money off the table, given an opportunity to do something that's so easy, so habit-forming, you don't even need to think twice about it. If you are not taking advantage of that opportunity, you will rue the day that you weren't finding religion early on.
I will tell you the objection that young people have, because I have written about group RSPs and I have talked about group RSPs, and they will say, listen, what's immediately pressing is my student loan debt. So maybe I'll sign up, but I'm certainly not going to maximize the benefit to maximize the match because I don't have the cash flow for it. What do you say to that objection?
You know what? Nature abhors a vacuum and lifestyles expand to fit your wallet. And if you start contributing, I believe young people that are starting out to work need to learn how to chew gum and walk at the same time. And you can pay down debt and save for the future. It's not an either or. I'm not a big believer that you sacrifice a latte to end up wealthy, but I am a big believer that you form these habits early on. And if you can convince yourself that the habit to save for your future is as critically important as the habit to pay down your student debt, you're going to win. If you can't, you're going to lose. It's as simple as that.
Number two is as old as the phrase, the Holy Trinity, I'm sure. Pay yourself first. The idea of saving in a retirement savings vehicle, or a vehicle that provides a tax incentive, if it's TFSA, if it's an RSP, whatever. What point would you want to make on that, that you believe is still missing in the discourse about those two vehicles?
So the way to think about saving for your future is to think about it holistically. We have a vision at Nest Wealth as we build this platform for the next generation of investing, and banks and insurance companies and the rest are using it, that any product should be able to go to any investor through any distribution channel. It's not the way it is right now. A lot of retirement options, a lot of advice has only been accessible to the very, very wealthy, those with $500,000, $1 million or more, and the floors were getting higher and higher to get access to those types of people. But what we've seen with the launch of digital advisors is that professional, sophisticated, customized advice to reach goals is now accessible to anyone across the country. And if you begin to understand that saving for your future is this combination of things, it's not just enough to save at work, it's not just enough to pay yourself first, you really have to come at it with everything you can, then you should start paying yourself first. You should start saving into these tax-efficient, even non-tax-efficient accounts, so you have access to the money maybe a little more readily if you need it for an emergency. You should start doing these things right away, because that same notion of nature abhorring a vacuum and lifestyles expanding to fill the amount of money in your account. Eventually, I know it sounds ridiculous to someone living paycheck to paycheck and someone who's finding it hard to make that next month balance. But if you start learning how to deduct the amount to go into savings early, you will start learning almost automatically how to adjust to the amount of income that you have left. It is something that as soon as you have that excess dollar, you should start learning your training yourself to take it off before you even recognize it's there.
Your third piece, don't give away your growth in fees. We know what you do for a living. We know the business that you run. This is about as on brand a point as you could possibly make, given that you and a couple of others are willing to really trying to stake the claim on the power of automated investment platforms, robo-advisors, whatever you call them. But I'm willing to let you make your case on why. Well, I talk about fees all the time. Tell us your spin on it, knowing that you are not an objective source here.
Well, hold on. I'm going to take that back, because this is all about objectivity, right? We didn't create the problem of high fees in this country. People look at Canadians and say we're not saving enough. The truth is we remain the highest fee country in the developed world when it comes to financial products. And people can see 30, 40, 50% of their possible wealth disappear over their investment lifespan because we pay 2.5% on mutual funds that have $1.5 trillion of Canadians' wealth right now. That is not something I came up with. It is a solution that was demanded by the market and what Canadians are fortunate enough to have right now. It's not just us. There are other low-fee platforms that exist, but we have thousands and thousands of Canadians that are recognizing that if I am saving 5% a year of my income, and the market's going up 5%, and I'm paying 2.5% in fees, I'm barely keeping up. So it is so critically important, whether you're saving at work and you're looking at the products that you have the ability to invest in, whether you're saving yourself and you're looking for a solution that is giving you guidance and making sure that the vast majority of your money stays in your pocket, watch the fees. It is like that holy trinity, the two pillars that the third position sits on top of is save at work, save at home, and then on top of it all is, but watch the fees, because if you're not investing in low-cost products, the best jobs you're doing as far as saving and preparing for your future could be getting undermined on a daily basis.
We have been talking about the fee thing for at least a decade. I've been talking about it for at least a decade, and yet the robos do not have 95% market share in this country.
No.
In large part, or at least in part, because many retail investors, many average Canadians feel like they really do need advice. Proactive advice, a hand to hold, a person they can call, a live human being they can go see it at a strip mall.
Right. And check to all those things. There's a misperception in Canada. The way that we were set up, the way the regulatory bodies allowed us to exist, is that human beings, professional managers, sophisticated advice, people you can talk to, fiduciary obligations, all exist at Nest Wealth and other digital advisors across this country. Everything you mentioned is possible with the digital advisor and provided in the flat monthly fee of $20, $40, or $80. And it's not that distinct or different.
Will one of your people come to my house?
If you invite us over for a meal, of course.
Will you take out the garbage while you're there?
Yeah, I mean, what do you
dust
want
a little bit?
No, but the notion is that people have never asked me to come to their house. What they want me to do is make sure that they can sleep well at night by creating a sophisticated, customized portfolio of low-cost products that's going to help them achieve their goals. And if we can do that, you know what? They'll send us a cookie instead of us coming to their house with a cookie gram.
I don't know if I'd trust your baking. You have many virtues, but can you bake?
I can bake pretty well.
Really? Yeah. All right. Randy Kass, thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
Randy Kass is with Nest Wealth. We were talking, we talked about all sorts of things, but we started by talking about the
religion.
Religion.
This
yes.
was an incredibly spiritual conversation. Geez,
and it was not Christianity. It was not Catholicism that
nope.
I began with.
Yeah, you started sweating when you
I did a little bit. A little bit.
Flashbacks.
Stay with us. Coming up next on the program, J.D. Power's Mike Foy is here to talk about the 2019 Canada Full Service Investor Satisfaction Study. Randy, you should listen to this because you're going to be happy to hear that satisfaction with full service investor firms is down.
Well, I'm not happy to hear that. I want everybody to be satisfied.
No, I don't believe it. We will also do our How I Do segment with Robert Irwin from Matchworth, talk about how he manages money. If you have questions, hey, you know, you could go old school and take one of my books out of the library. That'd be fun. Moolala, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things With Their Money and What You Can Do About It is the name of the first. You can also get it online at any of the online booksellers or your local bookseller around the corner. Stick around. We'll be right back after the break.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
A new study from J.D. Power shows that satisfaction with Canadian investor firms slipped this year for the first time since the financial crisis of 2008. Mike Foy is the senior director of the wealth management practice at the firm. He's here to tell us about the 2019 Canada Full Service Investor Satisfaction Study. Boy, that's a mouthful. And what it means for investors and investment firms alike. He's in Washington, D.C. Hello there, Mike.
Hi, how you doing?
Why did satisfaction decline in this most recent period?
Well, so we were in the field actually collecting data mostly during December of 2018. So if you think back to what was happening in the markets at that time, we were winding up a year where both the TSX and the S&P were down for the first time since the financial crisis. And we also had a spike in market volatility. So one big reason was that investors were feeling, I think, a little bit uncomfortable about where their portfolio was. And we saw that reflected in steep declines in particularly in investment performance satisfaction.
And the decline was most pronounced among higher net worth clients. What do you read into that?
Yeah, so, well, you know, age and wealth generally tend to be fairly correlated. And so, you know, if you are an older, wealthier investor, not only do you have more to lose when the market dips, but you have less time to recover, right? So if you're a millennial, say, and are decades away from retirement, you're probably much less concerned about fluctuations in the market today versus if you're somebody who's in retirement or close to retirement. Again, you have less time to recover your losses.
Are you accidentally reinforcing the stereotype of the grumpy old man?
I may be.
Jeez. Well, at least you can say it's data driven.
Exactly. That's right. It's all empirical.
77% of respondents. So this is kind of a random finding, but I thought it was interesting. 77% of respondents have not used their firm's mobile app. Surprising to me. Are the apps bad or are people Luddites?
Well, it may be a combination of both. So as you would expect, there's a big difference generationally. So we see just over two-thirds of millennials and younger investors saying they've had a mobile experience over the last 12 months compared to about 29% of boomers and older. So certainly there's a an element of how tech savvy folks are. But I think the industry would also acknowledge that they are a bit behind the curve when it comes to the mobile experience. And that's something that's increasingly important as younger investors accumulate more wealth. They're used to doing everything on mobile, and they're going to expect the same kind of ease of use and convenience from their wealth management providers that they get in other aspects of their lives as consumers.
A lot of money has been spent on the rollout of CRM2, IT changes, all this communication about it, training, all that stuff. But your survey points to some questions about whether investors really get it. What did you see?
Yeah, so, it's true. We've been looking at a series of metrics, but in particular, a question about investor understanding of their fees over the last, 5 or 6 years as the various CRM2 milestones have come and gone. And we've seen that number has remained stubbornly low. So this year, just 31% of Canadian full service investors said that they completely understood their fees. And that really has not moved significantly over the past few years. So it does raise some questions about how effective has CRM2 been, and how effective in general is disclosure if it's not accompanied by clear explanations, conversations directly with an advisor, an opportunity to ask questions and so on. Just adding disclosures doesn't necessarily improve transparency or drive understanding on its own.
I flagged a couple of the things that I thought were interesting from the survey results this year. What are some of the findings that you think are most relevant?
Well, I mean, one of the things, in addition to the fact that the satisfaction scores dropped, as we alluded to earlier, one of the things that was interesting to me was looking at what were the things that firms or advisors could actually do in a challenging market environment to kind of mitigate some of those negative impacts. And so we saw things like, communication, both proactive and responsiveness. So the percentage of clients who said that their advisor responded to them same day with a question or problem, that becomes more important in a volatile market environment. And also just the explanation of the performance, right? So obviously markets and economic conditions are outside of a firm or an advisor's control. But what they can do at least is sit down with their clients, explain to them clearly why their performance was what it was, help reorient them towards longer term personal goals and away from just being focused on market benchmarks. And just really ensuring that they, that they understand why they are where they are. We found that about a third of investors said their advisors didn't take the time to do that. But those who did were much more satisfied. They were much more likely or much less likely to say that their performance was worse than expected. So advisors just through, providing effective communications to their clients, can really help to get them through those difficult market times remaining loyal and satisfied with the relationship.
There is an intuitive relationship between consumer satisfaction and market share. We saw that play out in very practical terms when I work in packaged goods. You could read the consumer sat scores on Pampers diapers, and as they declined, market share declined. It was very clear. Financial services and investing in particular is quite different because those are relationships that are often forged once and they are maintained for a decade, decades or more. What insight do you have on the connection? Because my hypothesis would be that even though SAT scores are declining, the investment firms aren't really that incented to do much about it because their customers are already so loyal, to their detriment in some ways.
Well, I think, you know, you're right that customers are not going to be leaving in droves if satisfaction goes down slightly. But I think there are also, in addition to just retention, there are other significant outcomes that are correlated with satisfaction and positive experiences. So when we look at, for instance, the likelihood to refer, right? So wealth management is very much a personal referral-driven business. People who have higher satisfaction scores and a better client experience are dramatically more likely to make referrals of their advisor or their firm. They were also significantly more likely to say that they intend to invest more over the coming 12 months. So even if, you know, firms don't necessarily need to fear a mass exodus of their clients, they do need to worry about generating new business through referrals and gathering additional assets from their existing clients.
Interesting. Mike, thanks for your perspective on your study. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Mike Foy is the Senior Director of the Wealth Management Practice at J.D. Power. One of the ways we can improve how people behave when it comes to money is to talk about it. That is why we started this next segment. It's called How I Do It. And we ask a very basic series of questions about how our guests manage their own personal finances. Worth reiterating that I would not ask any question that I would not answer myself. Our guest today is Robert Irwin, co-founder of Matchworth. Robert, just the first thing that comes to your mind. You ready?
Ready.
You go to a coffee shop. Do you pay with cash, debit, or credit, and why?
Cash.
Why?
It's easier.
How come it's easier? I never have cash on me.
I always have pocket change. I have my loonies and toonies.
You do. And do you, when you get dressed in the morning, do you put pocket change into your pocket?
I always carry a few bucks.
What else do you use cash for?
Small grocery items.
Is it a conscious thing that you want to make sure cash is still a part of your life, or do old habits die hard?
I love cash.
You love cash. Why do you love cash?
It's just so tangible and it's real. And I spend less when I have cash in my hand.
Right. Well, the data would say that you do, because we know that credit cards debit cards anesthetize the pain of spending. What about your financial life is automated?
I would say at least 3/4.
Okay. So things like what? Bill payments?
All bill payments. Savings.
Savings in particular categories? Like, do you have a Christmas holiday fund or a vacation fund?
Yeah, I've got a squander fund.
Ooh, what's a squander fund?
Squander fund is, well, it's undesignated. That's the best part. It's definitely going to something squanderish.
Okay, we talked earlier about your penchant for shoes. Does that come out of your squander fund, or is that like a necessity?
That's a
milk
necessity.
Bread,
yeah,
shoes.
Milk bread shoes. Absolutely.
Right. What else would come from your squander fund?
Oh, ridiculous travel.
Okay, what is a place that you have been to recently that would fit the bill?
Heli-skiing.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, that's not cheap.
No.
You said you used to be a financial advisor. You spent 15 years as a financial advisor. Now you're kind of an entrepreneur. What is the number one thing that you have noticed that is different about this new life?
It's the highs and the lows are astronomically greater than anything I've ever experienced before.
Yeah, I can imagine. Okay, bill paying. How do you navigate bills?
Keep them low.
Keep them low, yes. Do you pay them the day they arrive in your email box or your actual mailbox?
I prepay. Including
for your funeral? Have you prepaid for
your
funeral?
I have not. No,
you've
that's
not prepaid
someone else's
for your
problem.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Deal with that. Choose a nice box.
That's
I'm
not
good.
Coming from the squander fund.
Okay, so you prepay what?
Well, basically, I'll lump some money into different credit cards. Sometimes I'll carry a credit on an electrical statement. account, just because I don't like being any penalties or anything else. Mm. There's some inefficiencies in that, but that's what I do. It's throw a few hundred extra dollars on something and let it sit there, and never do I have to worry about it.
Do you have a budget?
No.
Did you ever have a budget?
No.
What is your view of budgets?
I hate them.
Why do you hate them?
They're terrible.
Why are they terrible?
They don't work.
Do they harm children and animals?
You know what? The residual effect of budgeting has never been accounted for, and I think it's astronomical.
And what do you think? In all seriousness, why are you – I mean, I am no fan of them either, but tell me why you're
not. The
amount
of effort that goes into an individual to track and manage a budget, I think it's a long process, and that time and energy could be used better elsewhere.
What are you nuts about when it comes to money, and what are you casual about when it comes to money?
I'm nuts about rates of return.
Mm.
I'm casual about superfluous expenses.
When you were in the financial advisory world, how did you navigate the fee conversation with clients?
I switched from MFDA to IROC and managed that by just basically using ETFs as an alternative. And I didn't get paid on it.
And your business now matches investors with advisors. One of the challenges that these advisors are facing is, how do I make money if all of my clients get super intense around fees and I need to change the way I'm compensated? It's not an easy migration for some people.
No, there's a lot of pressures in that industry for sure. And they're going through some serious changes. And I think it's generally great for everyone involved. But there are serious growing pains involved.
How do you think about real estate? Is it an asset class for you? Is it a place to park your black leather couch?
That's two parts. From a living perspective.
Do you have a black leather couch?
I do not.
Okay. Just checking.
But it's the primary residence, whatever you live in, that's not an investment. And that's a problem in Canada. Everyone sees that as an investment. You can liquidate it if you move to something smaller and less expensive somewhere else. Everything beyond that is an investment asset class.
Do you invest in real estate for you as a part of your portfolio?
Yes.
How so?
Physical bricks and mortar, rental, and REITs.
Like income property?
Correct.
Right. Yeah. What is the best financial move you have ever made? And what is the worst?
I wonder if
just in case you have that answer. If that answer is top of mind.
Yeah, yeah. Best financial move, specifically, is an investment in an individual security. Constellation Software about 4.5 years ago. That's me personally. I've really enjoyed that run. Some of the worst ones, there's a lot
of stocks that didn't go that way.
Well, yeah, a lot of stocks outside of that, though. I mean, more specifically in, you know, over concentration, I would say.
Was the worst or the best?
Was the worst. Yeah. Making a too big of a bet into one asset class. This is a long time ago, but the damage.
We're talking 1999.
Oh, not long after that.
I remember those days.
2000.
Who files your taxes?
An accountant.
Have you ever done your own taxes?
Yes.
Why'd you make the switch?
I started making money.
And you thought, this is something to outsource,
And, you know, I would pay someone to do my budgeting as well.
Right. Robert Irwin, co-founder of Matchworth, thank you very much for joining us. Thanks for your candor.
Thank you.
All right. That is our show for today. You can subscribe to it on your podcast platform and write us a review. If you want to join in on the conversation, send us an email to ask@moolala.ca or participate on any of our social media channels. @BruceSellery is Twitter. Bruce Sellery Moolala is Facebook. Thanks very much for joining us, and have a great day.